This week's sponsor of Undisclosed is The Great Courses. Now, like so many of you, I love learning for my personal enrichment, and that's the motivation behind The Great Courses. I've got a number of their lectures now. I've gone through one of them, The Fundamentals of Photography, which I talked about before, and it was fantastic, and I'm really excited about getting into some of the other ones that I've ordered. The Great Courses, which is right now celebrating its 25th anniversary, has courses in over 500 subjects, from history to science to religion, philosophy, better living, culture, music, you name it, there is something for everyone. And they're available in video and audio formats and even digital formats, so you can download them right from their site. Right now, The Great Courses has created a special, and it's a limited time offer for Undisclosed listeners. If you order from 8 of their best-selling courses, including the one that I've already reviewed, The Fundamentals of Photography, you can get it at up to 80% off the original price. But again, this offer is only available for a limited time, so you want to order yours sooner rather than later. To take advantage of this offer, you want to go to thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Again, that's thegreatcourses.com/undisclosed. Hi, and welcome to the 9th addendum of Undisclosed, the State versus Adnan Syed. My name is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and national security fellow at the New America Foundation, and I blog at splitthemoon.com. And as always, I'm joined with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller. Susan is an associate at the Volkov Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. And Colin is an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he's also the blog editor of the Evidence Prof blog. Before we get into today's addendum, we wanted to address a new development in Adnan's case from last week. And that is the announcement that Adnan's motion to reopen his post-conviction appeal has been assigned to a judge. And it happens to be the same judge who presided over the original post-conviction petition a couple of years ago. Now, we've gotten a lot of questions about this, so we thought it would be best maybe for Colin to actually explain what it all means before getting into the addendum.
On May 18th, the Court of Special Appeals remanded back to the circuit court so that Adnan could file a petition to reopen his post-conviction proceeding so that Asia McClain could testify in support of his claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Thereafter, on June 30th, Adnan indeed did timely file his petition to reopen the proceeding. Now, both initial petitions for post-conviction relief and subsequent petitions to reopen post-conviction proceedings are governed by Chapter 400 of Maryland's Uniformed Post-Conviction Procedure Act. Now, some of the rules in this chapter distinguish between initial petitions and subsequent petitions to reopen. So, for instance, Rule 4-406 says a court must hold a hearing on an initial petition, but merely may hold a hearing on a subsequent petition to reopen. Reasoning being, according to the courts in Maryland, while everyone gets one bite at the apple, not everyone gets a second bite. What about the rule dealing with the timing of the state's response? That rule is 4-404, and it does not distinguish between initial petitions and subsequent petitions to reopen. Instead, it states, quote unquote, "The state's attorney shall file a response to the petition within 15 days after notice of its filing, or within such further time as the court may order. No other paper shall be filed except as ordered by the court." It's my strong belief that this rule, 4-404, applies to Adnan's petition to reopen, meaning the state had to respond within 15 days. And there's definitely some support for this argument. There's a Court of Appeals of Maryland case named Pfaff. It involved, like Adnan's case, a remand of a post-conviction proceeding, and in that case, the court cited to Rule 4-404's 15-day requirement. There's another case by the Court of Appeals of Maryland, Grandison. That's a case in which the defendant, like Adnan, filed a petition to reopen his post-conviction proceeding, and the state indeed did respond within 15 days. Finally, to me, it makes no sense the state would have more time to respond to a petition to reopen than an initial petition, for instance, in Adnan's case. His initial petition for relief cited 9 different claims, and it quoted to precedent from across the country. By way of contrast, his current petition to reopen only argues one point. It's based upon Maryland-specific law. Is it in the interest of justice to reopen the hearing? And that standard has only been cited in a handful of cases in Maryland. So again, if we're to assume that the deadline for the state to respond is 15 days, they're very much late because it's been a month and a half since Adnan filed his petition. Now, as the language of Rule 4-404 says, the judge does have discretion to give the state additional time to respond, but at this point in time, the state has not filed a request for an extension of their time to respond to the petition to reopen. If they're not given an extension, that means the judge in the case is going to decide whether to reopen based solely upon Adnan's petition without any written response by the state. So who is that judge? Well, on August 6th, Judge Martin Welch was assigned to handle the appeal in this case. Judge Welch was actually the judge who handled Adnan's initial post-conviction hearing back in 2012, and he's the one who denied him relief back in January 2014. 1 month after denying Adnan relief, Judge Welch retired, which means he's being brought back to the bench to hear this one case. So what's my take on Judge Welch? In my opinion, the appointment was fair to both sides. Obviously, he's well acquainted with the facts of the case. He's well acquainted with the law of the case, which means he can deliver a decision much more swiftly than another judge who would have had to get up to speed in all the facts and the law before rendering a decision. On the one hand, he's been retired for about a year and a half. He might be a bit rusty. On the other hand, unlike other judges, he's only handling this one case and isn't juggling several cases at the same time. The state might be happy because this is the same judge who denied Adnan relief back in 2014. It's tough to get a judge to reverse himself. On the other hand, what was the state's argument back in 2012 and 2014? It was that the judge couldn't give Adnan relief without Asia testifying. Well, now Adnan has evidence that Asia was, whether intentionally or not, dissuaded from testifying based upon a prosecutor from his trial. She's now willing to testify. And the defense would claim now Judge Welch therefore has every reason to reverse himself and to give Adnan relief. Overall, Judge Welch seems to be an excellent judge. He has great credentials, qualifications, etc. I'm sure he's going to render a fair judgment. Whether that judgment favors Adnan or the state, the Court of Special Appeals has already granted an appeal, and so therefore all these arguments being made now are going to be made once again before the Court of Special Appeals.
And I'll just add that because people are interested in knowing what the next step of this process is going to be, and that should be likely that a hearing will be scheduled, a hearing to hear the merits of the motion to reopen. But the hearing date has not yet been scheduled, and I'm sure as soon as it is, it will be publicly announced. My guess is that it'll be sometime this fall, but it is just a guess. It could take months and months. There's no telling. Getting to our addendum. In last week's episode, we discussed a series of cases involving systematic issues with how Baltimore's police, crime lab, and prosecution mishandled cases. And you heard some familiar names. Detectives Ritz, Massey, and McGillivray all made appearances in episode 9. Today, our addendum is about another case. And I want to warn our listeners that this is a deeply troubling Baltimore case about the senseless murder of a child. And it's a case in which the child's father was charged with a heinous crime. So why are we talking about this case? It's because Detective Massey and crime lab technician Van Gelder, both of whom were involved in Adnan's case, are part of the story. And also because the attorney for the defense was none other than Christina Gutierrez. On July 26, 1996, Richard Nicholas picked up his 2-year-old daughter, Aya, from her mother's house at approximately 6 p.m., Nicholas took Aya to the Golden Ring Mall in Baltimore and bought tickets for the 8 p.m. showing of The Adventures of Pinocchio. He then took Aya to have their photos taken at the Photo Fun Express at the mall. The pictures were found on Nicholas later that night, and the serviceman testified that the booth was used at 7:01 p.m., 7:43 p.m., 9:30 p.m., and 9:44 p.m. So at the earliest, the picture was taken at 7:01. Now, according to Nicholas, he then took Aya to the movie, which ended at approximately 9:30 p.m., and while driving home that night, another car was tailgating Nicholas's car and eventually bumped it. The other driver then drove next to Nicholas's car and started hurling racial epithets at him. Nicholas stopped his car and went around to look at his bumper. While there, he heard a gunshot, ran to Aya, and cradled her body. Nicholas then ran to a payphone and called 911, with police arriving about 12 minutes later. Aya was pronounced dead soon thereafter. According to the state, Nicholas bought tickets to Pinocchio, took Aya back to the car, fatally shot her at about 7:45 p.m., went to the movie to create an alibi, and then called 911 soon after 9:45 p.m. with this made-up story.
The evidence against Nicholas included GSR, which we discussed on last week's episode. In fact, Daniel Van Gelder, the same crime scene technician we discussed last week, also did the testing in Nicholas's case and testified that the GSR found in Nicholas's hands was due to Nicholas firing a gun. Although a defense expert did testify that the residue could have easily come from secondary transfer and expressly disagreed with Van Gelder's conclusions, Nicholas was ultimately convicted in large part because he had no one to corroborate his timeline.
Next, let's fast forward 19 years to March of 2015, so earlier this year. Turns out the state actually failed to turn over two witness statements regarding the events of the day in question. The first statement was actually taken by three detectives, Detective Gordon, Detective Glenn, and Detective Massey. Now, Massey, you might recall from last episode, is the detective who allegedly received the anonymous calls that led the Baltimore Police Department to focus upon Adnan. In addition, Massey, sort of interesting side note, we mentioned The Wire last week. Wendell Pierce, the actor who played Detective Bunk on The Wire, said he was the biggest influence. He worked with Massey in building this character. And in fact, Massey actually appeared as an actor on the show. Another interesting tidbit is, if you're listening to this on August 17th, Massey is actually scheduled possibly to testify tomorrow at a hearing involving the twice-reversed murder convictions of Clayton Coakley and Darnell Fields. The second time those murder convictions were reversed, it was based upon the state failing to disclose an internal affairs investigation into Massey and his partner, the allegation being they were falsifying overtime records by reporting that they were working overtime hours while in fact they were running errors or working at home. The state's response is they're trying to claim that quote-unquote personnel matters such as this are exempt from the Maryland Public Information Act and therefore inadmissible in court. So that's Massey's current situation. What about back to the Nicholas case? According to the court in the Nicholas case in March, while Massey and the other detectives took a statement from Jennifer McKinsey, they failed to disclose it. And so what did McKinsey say? According to McKinsey, back in 1996, she was staying at a Holiday Inn that was near the site of the shooting, and she heard a loud popping sound like a gunshot at around 9:45 p.m. Detectives also interviewed a Richard Benson. He was another guest at the Holiday Inn. And in similar fashion, he told the detectives he heard a loud sound like a car backfiring or exploding at around 10 o'clock p.m. on the day in question. And so this is exactly the corroboration that Nicholas needed at trial. Basically, witnesses saying they heard something like a gunshot around 9:45 or 10 p.m. at night. And yet the state failed in its Brady obligation. They didn't disclose the evidence, and the district court in Maryland found this was a Brady violation, this is material exculpatory evidence, and Nicholas is entitled to a new trial. The state is currently appealing that ruling up to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals.
There was a second claim for relief also raised by Nicholas. At trial, Dr. Dennis Shute testified that he had performed an autopsy on Aya 15 hours after the police came upon her body. According to Dr. Shute, Aya had fixed lividity on the back and left side of her body, which was consistent with her positioning in the car when the police arrived at the scene. You'll recall that lividity is a process of blood pooling in the lowest portion of the body after death. And Dr. Shute testified that the lividity usually takes 2 hours to settle, and it cannot become fixed in 12 minutes. Therefore, Dr. Shute concluded that Nicholas's story could not be correct and that Nicholas must have shot her before the movie.
If you'll recall from episode 5, this isn't correct. As Dr. Levati told us, lividity typically takes between 8 to 12 hours to become fixed. Now, certain factors can affect that, like the temperature. If it's cold, then it takes longer generally, and if it's very hot, it can happen quicker. And the victim's health prior to death can also affect how fast lividity will set. And it's also possible that in young children, lividity may become fixed at a faster rate, perhaps even as little as half the time that it would take for an adult. However, at the very earliest, you'd expect lividity to be fixed in about 4 hours, if it's true that for children, it takes half that amount of time. In no case should lividity have taken 2 hours to fix. So here we have a trial, Dr. Shute testifying that because lividity was fixed on Aya's side as she was found in the car, Lividity must have been fixed before the police were ever called and arrived on the scene. But we know Aya had been alive 2 hours before because her mother had seen her, which means that no matter when Aya died, Lividity could not have been fixed in the way Dr. Shute testified at trial.
Yeah, and it's weird too because, as you said, some experts tend to think that Lividity can become fixed more quickly in children. There's actually never been a peer-reviewed study on it, but some have speculated that. But it appears Dr. Shute is not among those who believe that, because just 2 years ago, Dr. Shute is now a medical examiner up in New York, and he was testifying in a case in which the victim was 21 months old. And his testimony in that case was that the lividity in the victim, the 21-month-old child, would have become fixed 8 to 12 hours after death, that exact same timeline that Dr. Levati told us about, and the conventional wisdom among those in forensic pathology. So that takes us then to the question of, well, what happened in the Nicholas case? Again, I have no idea why or how Dr. Shute ended up testifying it takes 2 hours for lividity to become fixed. What we do know, though, and this might help to explain it, is there was no testimony at trial about the positioning of Aya's body in the 15 hours before she was brought to the medical examiner's office. Dr. Shute himself said he was completely unaware of the positioning of the body during this time. And so one possibility to consider is that Aya was on her left/back for those 15 hours, which then would explain the lividity, whereas, again, it makes no sense that lividity was fixed within 2 hours after death, going under the state's theory of the case. The problem for Nicholas, though, was that his defense counsel at trial really didn't develop this issue and didn't call her own medical expert at trial. And so in addition to claiming the Brady violations we mentioned a minute ago, Nicholas also claimed he received the ineffective assistance of counsel, especially given the fact that the prosecution argued strongly to the jury during closing with regard to the defense, where was their medical examiner, where was their forensic pathologist? Unfortunately for Nicholas, while he was successful on Brady, which is certainly great, it would give him a new trial, the court rejected the ineffective assistance claim in large part because they relied upon the claim back in 1998 by defense counsel that while she didn't call a forensic pathologist to trial, she had consulted with a forensic pathologist. Turns out the attorney who was representing Nicholas at trial was none other than Christina Gutierrez, the same attorney who represented Adnan at his trial back in 1999 and 2000. So the question is, was Gutierrez telling the truth? Again, I can't answer that question. What I can tell you is we'll do a full episode on Gutierrez down the road, and she had a record number of client complaints against her, including several complaints that led to compensation based upon her taking client money, promising to hire experts, and then pocketing that money for her own uses and never hiring those experts.
And besides, if she actually did talk to a forensic pathologist, unless she got a really bad one, there's no way she could have concluded after that that she did not reasonably or strategically call them to testify.
Yeah, and I actually talked to a few of the forensic pathologists that I have talked with before, and they all said regarding this case, it makes no sense. Given what was the claim by the state in this case, any halfway decent forensic pathologist would have been able to say, no, the state's case makes no sense, and you should call me at trial to explain why the state's timeline makes no sense.
So yeah, the court's conclusion now that Gutierrez was not ineffective, well, that part doesn't make sense to me either.
You generally take an attorney at his or her word and expect that they did what they said they did. Unfortunately for Nicholas and Adnan, and many clients represented by Gutierrez, it turns out that her word, at least in this general time frame of the late 90s, really didn't mean too much.
Colin, do you know what the court in the recent Nicholas case found? Did they even discuss the possibility that even if Gutierrez had consulted with a pathologist, she was still unreasonable for failing to call one at trial?
Their claim, according to the court, is it wouldn't have helped Nicholas because it would have further contradicted his own timeline. Again, his timeline being the police came upon the body 12 minutes after she was shot. My thinking is, and my thinking if it goes to trial again, is you argue that it's a mistake by Shute and they didn't say the body positioning was X or Y in those 15 hours. So my thinking is you call the forensic pathologist at trial and you claim clearly that state's timeline doesn't make sense. Sure, It's not consistent with the defense timeline. The point is, it was done wrong. The validity evidence in this case is not correct. You throw it out. You don't simply leave evidence in that shows the state's timeline could make sense, the defense timeline makes no sense. No, you blow them both up and say the medical evidence here makes no sense.
Well, I don't even think it really blows up Nicholas's timeline because, I mean, the result's impossible. We know she wasn't dead for more than 2 hours. So no matter what that pathologist said, his conclusions could not have contradicted Nicholas's timeline.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I'd be very interested to see what the Fourth Circuit has to say. I agree with you. I don't see a downside to calling a medical expert. The district court gave deference to Gutierrez's claim that she consulted with an expert and figured there must have been a reason. As we've seen with Gutierrez, I don't know that that deference is justified.
But we know that the prosecution, at least, considered that their timeline evidence based on lividity was their case and the whole case. Because after the conviction, the prosecutor sent a letter to Dr. Shute saying that the lividity evidence was, in fact, the whole case and that the prosecutors were 100% certain that it was his testimony that had gotten the conviction against Nicholas. The letter from the prosecutor to Dr. Shute then goes on to state, "We learn from an unimpeachable source that the defense did not spot the significance of Dr. Shute's findings before we raised the issue in open court."
When I saw this letter, I was just completely shocked because this language is so strange. An unimpeachable source. I mean, who outside of the defense team would know that Gutierrez didn't understand the lividity evidence? It sounds like you either have someone after the case who goes to the prosecution and relays the work product of the defense to the prosecutor's office, or, and I know this sounds a bit wacky and a bit out there, but could there possibly have been a mole that was inside Gutierrez's office? And I say, you know, it sounds a bit wacky and I understand that it's a bit tinfoil hatty, but it turns out there actually is precedent for this in Maryland. There was a case, Weiner versus State, and it involved the Maryland State Attorney General investigating allegations against a public defender. That public defender also had a private practice, and the allegation was that this attorney was misusing state services and personnel as part of his private practice. And so the state, the assistant attorney general, decides, we're going to have a law student go undercover and volunteer in this attorney's office to determine what's going on. Was that what happened here? I don't know. All I know is it's clear to me that someone from the defense team, 1996, 1997, is telling the Baltimore prosecutor's office that Gutierrez didn't understand the lividity evidence. And we also know that Gutierrez was, in fact, being investigated in the late 90s based upon misconduct. And so could have been a mole, could have been someone who was unhappy with what Gutierrez was doing. But one way or another, this information came from the defense team and Gutierrez to the prosecutor's office.
The only other option I can think of is that possibly whatever pathologist Gutierrez talked to, if she actually talked to one, could have led the defense astray. Other than that, though, it seems pretty clear that someone from the defense, someone from Gutierrez's office, was disclosing things to the prosecution.
But doesn't that theory only work if then that forensic pathologist, after leading her astray, then reports that back to the state?
Yeah.
She has no idea. I mean, the real issue here is the source of this information, right? Because what's clear is that the Baltimore prosecutor's office should not have known, but they did know about Gutierrez's issues with lividity, even at the time of Adnan's trial. So does this explain why the prosecution premised its entire case on the 709 and 716 Lincoln Park pings, despite the lividity evidence not matching this timeline? Did they know that Gutierrez wouldn't understand the lividity evidence and wouldn't properly contest it? I mean, we don't know, but what we do know is that there is exactly one reference to a defense medical expert in the defense files. It's a handwritten note on what appears to be a small notebook page. It has the word Syed circled and has a line drawn to the words for Julie. Next to Syed, it says Dr. Robert Kirshner, Medical Examiner, Chicago. And we think this refers to an ME from Chicago, medical examiner from Chicago, who unfortunately passed away in 2002. And we think also that the Julie referenced in the note is Julie Remy, the law clerk who spoke to Sarah from Serial. From what Julie said on the podcast, it sounds like she didn't even work on the Don's case. So was Dr. Kirshner ever contacted? And if so, did Gutierrez understand what he told her? If the Nicholas case is any indication, the answer to one of these questions is no.
And whatever was going on, Gutierrez's highly unorthodox reliance on law students is itself troubling. We'll get into this more in later episodes, but it does seem like Gutierrez was delegating very critical parts of the defense to second and third year law students who were interning in her office.
This Twitter question comes from Liam. His Twitter handle is at LJMGordon, and he asks, let's imagine all goes well and Adnan is ultimately acquitted and released. Would he be compensated or could he sue the police department? Sort of a complicated answer. First, if you look at Adnan's current legal claims, they're for ineffective assistance of counsel. That's based upon the failures of his privately retained attorney. And so if he wins on those grounds, he wouldn't be entitled to any compensation from the state. Let's say, on the other hand, that there's DNA testing and it points to some third party being the killer, or let's say there's a Brady violation, the state failed to disclose certain evidence. Maryland has a statute that says the Board of Public Works in Maryland determines compensation packages if people are wrongfully convicted. And one recent example is the case of Bernard Webster. He was given $45,000 compensation for each of the 20 years he was in prison, so $900,000. But here's the twist. Maryland is actually one of the 8 most restrictive states in the country with regard to compensation. The only way under this Maryland law that the Board of Public Works can give compensation is if the governor of the state of Maryland issues a pardon that says the conviction was conclusively determined to have been an error. And so even if there is strong evidence that points to Adnan's innocence, there's some real legal obstacles in the state of Maryland to prevent this compensation from taking place. There's a final option, and that is if Adnan is eventually released based upon a Brady violation, DNA testing, etc., he could bring a claim under Section 1983 of 42 U.S. Code. That, again, though, would be a bit of a tough case. There's a recent Supreme Court opinion from 2011, Connick versus Thompson. That's a case where there was non-disclosure of a blood test in a murder case. And actually, that evidence, the blood test, was disclosed a mere month before John Thompson, the defendant, was to be executed. Turned out the blood test showed that the blood of the killer didn't match the blood of Thompson. He was exonerated. He then sued the prosecutor's office. And what the court found was a single Brady violation by a prosecutor's office is not enough to get recovery under Section 1983 against the prosecutor's office. Instead, you have to show a pattern of similar violations. What about Adnan suing the police department? There, it's a bit clearer that he could have a winning case, because while individual prosecutors are immune from 1983 lawsuits, detectives are potentially liable. In that case, Adnan would have to show bad faith. In other words, the detectives withheld evidence and violated his guaranteed access to evidence. And so if it turns out that some of this Brady material, witness statements, et cetera, was not turned over to Adnan, that might be his best avenue for civil recovery, is under Section 1983 and bad faith by the detectives.
So now we have a question from Sephra Lopez, whose Twitter handle is at Sephra Marie. And Sephra asks, has anyone heard if the detectives have any comments on what has been found as of late? And the answer to that is no. The detectives haven't talked to us, and as people might recall, they did not talk to Sarah and Cyril, and nobody from the state has reached out to us. But of course, if they want to talk to us, we would love it. We'd love to talk to them. So the invitation is wide open.
This next Twitter question comes from Beth MG. Her Twitter handle is at Zwiderian22. She asks, would Brady violation be enough for retrial, or is more needed to free Adnan without a plea? As we've mentioned before and earlier today, a Brady violation is the state failing to disclose material exculpatory evidence. Evidence is material when it undermines confidence in the jury's verdict. And so based upon that, automatically, if a defendant proves a Brady violation, they're entitled to a new trial. It's a due process violation. And so, yeah, if the court finds in this case evidence was not disclosed in its material, automatically Adnan is going to get a new trial.
We opened up today's addendum with a discussion of the Nicholas case, a case in which, frankly, the defendant may very well be guilty of the crime he was charged and then convicted of. While it's not news to attorneys, it's important for those who don't have a legal background to understand that under the U.S. Constitution, all criminal defendants are entitled to legal counsel. And most criminal defense attorneys will represent many, many guilty clients in their careers. So we at Undisclosed, with the information we have, can't make a judgment call about Nicholas's innocence or guilt, but we can make a judgment call about the quality, or lack thereof, of the investigation, the forensics, and his defense. Because regardless of the guilt or innocence of their clients, it is defense counsel's job to test the veracity of the state's case. For me, the reason this is vital is not just for the sake of the defendant. It's also for the sake of the victim. If police, crime labs, prosecutors, and defense counsel don't do their jobs right, it doesn't just mean that an innocent person can get convicted. It also can mean that a criminal gets away. And that is perhaps the greater tragedy of mishandled cases, that they're missed opportunities for justice for the victim. Now, moving forward, we've established that police and state mishandling, misconduct, witness coercion, and all kinds of improper things can and have happened in Baltimore, leading to multiple wrongful convictions. And of course, there may be many more we will never know about, or at least don't know about yet. But getting back to Adnan's case, what if, beyond the kinds of impropriety we discussed, an even more serious violation took place? A Brady violation that was never disclosed to the defense and has never been reported before that turns the case on its head. We've spent a long time investigating this new information, information that's actually from an anonymous source and left us all shocked. And we are finally ready to talk about it. Next time on Undisclosed. A special thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, to Baluki, who designed our logo, and to Amar Naji, our sound editor. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us online on social media on Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @undisclosedpod. Tweet us your questions and comments using the hashtag undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.